sits on thrones, the philosophies of men. We are the Quorum.
Hello, everyone. Last week, Matt put together a dramatic reading of some letters written in the late 1940s between Lowry Nelson, a professor at the University of Minnesota, and the First Presidency. The gist of the letters was basically this. Nelson, who was an active member, was asked by a mission president out of Georgia for his opinion about doing missionary work in Cuba, since Nelson had extensive experience in the region, and the church was trying to figure out how exactly they could get in and convert all the whiteys while ignoring the blacks, because black people were, quote, not entitled to all the blessings of the gospel. Yay, Mormonism! Anyway, after receiving this letter, Nelson was understandably appalled and wrote the First Presidency to basically ask, are you really sure that God's down with racism? And wonder of wonders, they actually responded, and it turned into something of a showdown between big old Lowry Balls Nelson and the First Presidency about the church's stance on the Negro, as they called it. The exchange is absolutely fascinating, and believe me, this watered-down summary just does not do it justice. So if you haven't heard it yet, or even if you have, I highly recommend going back to the Lowry Nelson versus George Albert Smith episode and giving it a listen. It's pretty incredible. Don't worry, I'll wait. I'll wait. Okay, all right, we good? We good? Okay. Anyway, in the wake of that episode, a lot of listeners asked for a follow-up discussion about these letters, so that's what we have for you today, as Glenn, Matt, John, Bob, and Tom talk about racism, the priesthood ban, racism, the church hierarchy, and racism. Enjoy.
Did you like the one about the king, the loyalty to the king? That one's a little...
Yeah.
That's funny.
That was funny.
All right, so we did these Lowry letters, released them about a week ago, and we've had several people say we'd like to hear a conversation about them. So we're here to talk about them.
Yeah, because whatever they want, we give them.
That's right.
That's right. We are men of the people, really.
Yeah.
Right.
So had any of you all read those before? Were you familiar with them?
No.
Nope.
I saw him go around circles, you know, a couple of years back or whatever, but I had too much other stuff, I guess, and I just never connected.
Yeah, I was just shocked that they aren't as popular as I guess I would expect them to be, because I consider them real smoking guns on a number of different levels. So, and I've noticed since we put it out, they are being retread and reshared, and a lot of people are finding them. Independent of us, it seems like somebody's finding them and then sharing them, and then somebody will comment, oh yeah, there was a podcast on it, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
That's good.
To me, it's kind of like the Pullman 1984 General Conference talk story that I had never heard anything about that either until Scott brought it up and we did a podcast on that, but it kind of hit me in the same way, like, wow, how is this not more well known, that this kind of stuff has happened, and there's no way that the church can really hide from it, because it's right there.
And yet they try to with these the most recent essays.
Yeah.
That it seems that they either assume people won't find these, connect them, or won't care, I guess, at some point. But see, I always thought that whole the faithlessness or the lack of faith in the pre-existence was a Bruce R. thing. That's what I was always taught, and he acknowledged that he was just wrong. To see it in such official terms from the First Presidency is what was, I guess, what was somewhat jarring to me, because I always thought it was just, like I said, it was a Bruce R. thing.
But no, but he didn't create stuff. He just, like, codified it, put it in that Mormon doctrine book. But he wasn't coming up with things, I don't think.
I think a lot of the stuff in Mormon doctrine, he was just kind of coming up with, pulling out of his ass, and it was just
no. And who's right, John? Tell us who's right.
Well, he's pulling together all of this stuff from all of the printed materials, so he's the one who has read all of these.
But he's not creating it out of whole cloth. He's not pulling it out of his ass. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Off.
Well, some people say I want to get this relationship right. He is Joseph Fielding Smith's son-in-law? Is that accurate? Bruce R. has some.
Yeah, he was gonna
be by something. Marriage, I believe it's Joseph Fielding, and Joseph Fielding was also kind of so some people say, if I remember right, is that Mormon doctrine is just an amalgamation of his father-in-law's shit, because he did a lot of writing as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, but even that isn't he's not creating it. It's yeah. stuff that came from before. It might be obscure sources, but it's a very conservative line of thinking that they. You know, he put into print, McConkie did. But anyway, I mean, we're getting away
yeah,
from
I mean,
the Lowry stuff.
I agree.
But I think where it connects is that Lowry says, I heard about these things in conversations. I heard about them in lessons, but I didn't know that there was any official word. And please tell me that there's not an official word. And that was the reason why he contacted George Albert Smith in the first place and then got the response back. Nope, this is it.
See, what I find the most telling to me is when, you know, I listen to you guys read those letters and then reading some of this additional material that we're going to cover tonight, is this guy was 100% vindicated. And it's sad to me that the church at the time was, you know, constantly putting him in his place like, no, this is the way it was, you know, the way it is and the way it'll always be. And then 1978 comes around, and it's like now the church has got egg on their face, and he was like, what'd I say? You know, insert, I told you so.
It, to me, it was just to listen to those letters or read those letters and then to claim some form of inspiration or revelation. Well, who's got it? Is it Lowry, or is it these guys who were the first presidency? Because it seems pretty clear Lowry has some, at least in his progressive views, certainly has more of a pipeline to God, if there is a God.
Right. Well, it seems like the church never wants to admit that something happens because they had a conversation with a regular member. It's always like, whenever there's a revelation, it's like, this is completely unrelated. We don't, you know, there's nothing going on in society. It's 1978. It's a random year. You know, it's blacks get the priesthood now. It has nothing to do with anything. God just said it. Like, oh, okay. And they just don't want to admit that there's connections to change and conversations and people who brought it up before, because that's like admitting that God isn't involved in some way.
Right. It's validating an alternative source for information, which they tried to invalidate in Lowry's case by saying, we're not going to be what is it that he said? I'm not impressed. I'm not going to be impressed by the reasoning of men or something like that.
However persuasive or
it
however
may sound.
Yeah. However well read. We should pull it anyway. Yeah. No, that was the other thing that just struck me was the year 1947, and I've never really considered the race issue in the church in the context of World War II. It was always, you know, 1970. It was always the civil rights movement, and clearly they were behind the times of the civil rights movement, you know, the 60s, 70s. But to have Lowry lay it out and say we just fought a war over these concepts was just to me a gut punch. Just right. Wow! I guess I've never thought of it in those terms, or never articulated it, or heard it articulated in those terms, and that's damning to me. You're like Hitler, is what he said.
No.
Do you wonder if everything about the church is this way? It's just that this is a documented case where we actually have letters, but it's all just a bunch of dudes just flying by the seat of their pants. They don't know any better than any of the rest of us as society moves on and changes, and this is just a glimpse into that. Like, if we had internet-level documentation with open books, pretty much the church would have damned itself in this same way like 70 times over again, right? It's just that
it would be constant. The only reason why we're not particularly familiar with this, with even this case, which has been out there forever, mm-hmm. is that everybody is focused like a laser on Joseph Smith, and that's all they really, you know, we go back to and care about. I mean, what other things do you even know about George Albert Smith?
Right.
You know, but all of his stuff is, I mean, this is all of this is available. My friend Newell Bringhurst is a great scholar on the issue of race in Mormonism, and he's been just amazed and
kind of disgusted by the amnesia that Mormons have today, where all of these statements like that we're reading here in these letters, this is not the only, this is not like the smoking right. gun. Yeah. All of the statements are like that. These are going, they're, and so he's been working on publishing a documentary history of, you know, modern pronouncements of Mormon first presidencies, you know, that are all identical to this. And, you know, so that, and publishing that with the University of Illinois Press so that, you know, people can remember, wait a second, guys, you know, this was just, this is just par for the course. This is entirely what it's like. And it's not one smoking gun. It's just every, all their communication.
And I want to go back to the way that you phrased it, Bob, because you said flying by the seat of their pants. I don't see it as flying by the seat of their pants as much as they're going back to previous tradition. And that, right. I mean, they're not really creating anything new in and of themselves, which is what's frustrating to a guy like Lowry Nelson, where he's saying, look at the world around us. Let's change the institution to fit the needs of mankind that we see. And they're going back to, well, this is what Brigham said, this is what Joseph Smith said, and we're not right. going to deviate from that at all. So, you know, flying by the seat of their pants, meaning that they're not really getting much in the way of new information, but they're holding really strongly conservatively to the old stuff.
But isn't that just an indictment that they don't get revelation? And so yeah. when you don't get revelation, you just will revert to what the last guy said, and the last guy reverts to the last guy. And it goes all the way back to Joseph Smith, because that was the only guy who had the balls to say, I speak for God. And even Brigham Young was like, ooh, not me. I just kind of... I'm the president, but I'm not the prophet. And so it's kind of that.
Wait, what? About Brigham Young? I don't know if I follow that.
I'm saying I think even Brigham Young felt inadequate in his failure, his inability to do what Joseph did prophetically and theologically, and that he expected that to come, and it didn't. And I think he had real moments of, the inferiority complex of being a prophet, and so as a result he overcompensated by being a huge asshole to everyone in the form of government and secular.
But weren't there things that Brigham Young knew that he couldn't pass on his own word, and so he said that Joseph Smith said this even though he may not have? Didn't you say that last time we talked about Brigham Young, John, or did I get that wrong?
No, exactly, because the point is that Joseph Smith had a different place in everybody's heart than Brigham Young ever right. accomplished, you know, and so Brigham Young had different capacities, and he ended up winning in some respects, but he was never able to imitate every single thing that Joseph Smith had in terms of having the love and the respect and where everybody would just hang on his every word as if he himself was, you know, had a window into exactly how everything works.
Yeah, because so. I wonder.
Gotcha, Tom.
I mean, as soon as he's dead,
I didn't see that.
He's dead, his doctrine, the Adam Robin? God doctrine.
I got you to yawn.
Well, the reason I'm wondering about Joseph Smith, I'm wondering if he's really the origin of the real racist, prohibitive blacks in the priesthood doctrine, because we know he ordained Elijah Abels, and there were, you know, others. He had a different attitude, maybe at different times, towards this issue. But Brigham was pretty much written in concrete the whole time. So I wonder if this is one of those issues where maybe Brigham Young makes Joseph look a little different than he actually could have been if they're going all the way back. But I don't know.
This is one of those.
Yeah.
So
Joseph
Smith,
it has to be, right? We know that historically.
Yeah. Well, Joseph Smith though had all kinds of. He would say one thing and then he'd say the other thing. So he does. He actually has an ambiguous legacy on this issue. So it may well be that in the course, even certainly the Book of Abraham, there's a basis for some of this. So his thinking may be evolving, and it may well be that in his ideas about this Mason, when he becomes a Mason and he starts to adopt Masonry as a temple thing, then that may well be where it creeps in. And so it could be him who's kind of introducing it, or at least in that trajectory that would be different from his previous practice when he was ordaining.
And didn't he? I mean, Joseph Smith often concede to political pressures, and so he'd kind of flip-flop positions a little bit. It seems like this race, like I heard that somewhere. Maybe it was like a Mormon Stories podcast on Elijah Abels or something where they talked about that.
The Mormons were very prepared to just concede on the thing when they were living in Missouri, you know, to deal with the Missourian neighbors. Right. So like, yeah, we're not
friendly
at all. You know, we're not. Right. Yeah, exactly. And then,
an issue then, right? Is that they were Northerners and they were allowing freed slaves to join their church, and that was kind of progressive at the time. I am right about that, aren't I? Historically,
right. Yeah, no, they were, and ordaining Black people to the priesthood too, so that was happening. But then when they're kind of also headquartered in Missouri, and the Missourians are very much against that, then they'll write letters that say, "Oh, well, we're not doing that. We never had any ideas about that at all." And then when they leave Missouri, and the Missourians are their enemies, then Joseph Smith has this political platform where, you know, he's a whatever you call it, a person who wants to recolonize all the Black people back to Africa. You know?
But there was also a guy, I think his name was Green Flake. Does that sound right to you, John? He was a 16-year-old servant or a slave. He was a slave, and he was given to the church in Nauvoo. I think it was like 46. He was given to the church as tithing.
Okay.
And so Brigham took him as a slave in the form of tithing. So I don't think it was just the Missouri period, but I'd have to look that up.
Well, no, and we know Utah was a slave state when it became part of the Union. Yeah. Was it just as a territory, not as a state?
Yeah.
I thought that when they became a state.
No, there's no slave states when they became a state.
Oh, okay.
Because it was after the Civil War.
But it was a territory. But in fairness. They were known.
We need to go back to
Schoolhouse Rock
for that one.
they were known to treat their slaves better than other people treated their slaves. So it's kind of like, you know, good slavery versus bad slavery.
Celestial slavery,
right?
Yeah.
But George Albert does this. He does refer not to Brigham. He just says this has been the way it was from the time of Joseph onward. It's been this way, and it's never not been this way, basically.
Yeah, but we already had Randy was saying in the last podcast that Thomas Monson pretty much, you know, is talking about your home teaching companions back to the time of Joseph, you know.
Right.
So it all gets attributed back because there's no changes, because this is, the church is now the same now in the past forever, you know.
Go to Jesus' time, really.
So if you were to
and back to Adam.
Right.
if you were to quantify modern revelation from the church's inception to today, is it fair to say that it's like, this is just a wide generalization out of my ass, but it's like 80% Joseph Smith, 10% Brigham Young, and then each progressive prophet is like tiny, 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 until like you get to Thomas S. Monson, which is like 0.000. Like, it'd be an interesting visualization just to look at the revelation of the church over time and recognize that it's like there is none, right? It's all like Joseph Smith and then everybody else trying to figure out what to do with that. Is that fair?
What would you be quantifying? Because what has there even been since Joseph Smith, other than one section from the DNC from Brigham Young, one section from Joseph F. Smith, and two official declarations, which have now taken on the status of revelation, even though.
Yeah, I guess that's even more to the point. If you look at official only stuff, then it's like 99% Joseph. I was just thinking like legacy, like because
practice type stuff.
Yeah, Brigham Young doesn't have
correlation has to account for something of it's had a such an influence. I don't know.
And Brigham Young
was correlation created by revelation, though. In other words, so all of these practices that have evolved, so a huge proportion of the practices and the lived church experience is wildly different. If it's almost nothing that's the same as what was happening at Joseph Smith's day, but those changes haven't occurred because of revelation. There's evolutions in practice that are primarily bureaucratic,
organizational. Yeah,
wow.
Sure.
I was like trying to be generous and be like, yeah, the church has had some modern revelation. You guys are like, nope, none since Joseph Smith. It's like two documents.
Well, but it could be policy changes and cultural practice changes as well that you're talking about, right, Bob? So like if you're talking about home teachers, you're talking about a 3-hour block, or you know, wearing a shirt and a tie and having white lace to cover the bread and water for sacrament. Like, there's probably going to be a lot of deviation, and maybe
word of wisdom getting canonized, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but yeah.
But the word of wisdom was already canonized.
Well, that's the wrong word, but actually followed in a way.
Having the temple recommend.
Yeah, that
stuff. And questions and, you know, like garments and garment changes, things that they didn't really have widespread in Joseph's times that maybe he initiated, but Brigham Young really established. I don't know. It's an interesting
question. But if there's any of those things are revelation, so why isn't there a moment when...
None of them's revelation.
Is it in the I know, but in other words... Okay. Yeah, well, I would say, why wouldn't you have this thing? If we're giving it, Bob is saying the benefit of the doubt or whatever, why wouldn't you have a thing just in conference where you're saying, well, the Lord has revealed to us that we can now have, you know, two-part garments.
Right.
Or whatever it is. Yeah. You know, it doesn't have to be that. It could be something less embarrassing.
Well, that's part of the heart of the issue here is the difference between revelation and a policy change. And that's where it gets really fuzzy because I guess I was using them interchangeably because I was wanting to plot on a timeline just the evolution of the church. And I was using revelation as a shorthand because I thought, you know, that's the church's language and that's how the church phrases everything. Like, oh, when blacks get the priesthood, it's revelation. Or, two-piece garments. Depending on which member you ask at which time, it could be a revelation. It could just be a policy change. It's just kind of fuzziness. But overall, the church is changing, and that's the whole point of revelation. And modern revelation is like, look how, you know, in tune with God we are, which is ironic because in truth, the church is always behind the rest of the world for being, you know, directly connected to God.
Well, Hinckley was asked, give us a revelation. What's a revelation you have? And on one of those interviews, and it was right after the conference center was built, and he said, you know, this building we're sitting in, that was a form of, it planted a seed, and there was inspiration, and now we have this building. And I remember even at the time as a member, as a believer, thinking, seriously?
Building that's it?
Building a big building is your revelation? Well, shit, Trump, baby, that guy's got revelation all over the place. So that was kind of his best answer. A lot of people would say changing things to the small temple thing was revelatory.
That's maybe a big temple of something that's nothing but is a big
Hinckley doing like the temple lights, the smaller temples to
have, right.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So it can be more people could have access to them rather than having a full blown.
I remember also the do you guys remember the perpetual education funds? You know, small tangent here, but when was announced, I was like, this is huge. It's a revelation.
You thought that?
I did. I was like totally.
I love Tom's face.
Is that lame? Come on, Tom. You have to admit you felt a warm fuzzy. It was in the priesthood session, and it was like God was channeling. He was speaking to us through the prophet. No.
Proclamation to the world for the proclamation of the family or whatever. That was the closest thing to anything that's modern revelation. And even that's hotly debated that even counts.
That's
whatever.
Funny. Because when I read that, I was like, this is like, I already know this, guys. You put it on
one. Dude, do you know how many homes have that framed, like, next to the Jesus
in the temple? For no reason whatsoever. It says nothing that isn't already known. Like, there's nothing new in it. It's the
And?
Well, the
it has the First Presidency signatures on it. That's all you need.
I'm thinking of things that actually are impactful changes, not just like, we believe in the family. Like, tell me something I don't know.
Anyway.
Why is that a revelation?
Gender's eternal, Bob.
Yeah. All
right. I didn't know that before.
That penis you have will stay with you eternally.
Thanks
well, unless
for clarifying, church. I didn't know. Wow.
Anyway, so Lowry Nelson, you remember that guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about him?
But this is a great. This is the conversation that prompts about revelation, and it has to, and especially again in context of the essays. To me, these just obliterate the essays when you know basically Mike Tannehill's position on it is right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, let's clarify that, but I totally agree.
Yeah.
Right, but, it's the church's position. Yeah.
So can we
when you think about Lowry Nelson though, like think about where he gets authority, what is his source of knowledge and what is his gospel? It's his education. And he's always going back to what he knows of the world as a sociologist, even to the point of deigning to instruct the prophet of the church on culture and sociology.
His experience. I thought it was interesting for him to say that these issues of racism that kind of happen in first world countries and particularly in the States, they're not here they're not in Chile like they are in the States. And if the church comes here, they'll actually make these people worse.
In Cuba? Chile?
Cuba. I'm sorry. Yeah. Did I say Chile?
Yeah.
one of the sea countries.
Right. Yeah.
Well, the other
Canada.
To also mention though, the other thing that he does make in his argument is he's saying, why are we fixated on, you know, this sort of ancient Hebrew Iron Age kingdom,
right,
ethnocentric
right.
things. When right. we're not ancient Hebrews, we're Christians, and I don't read anything about anything like this in either the letter or the spirit of the teachings of Jesus. So he actually makes that argument too.
That was something I wanted to talk about a little bit, because I found that really interesting when he was talking about the progression of the Hebrew people in the Old Testament, and that his view of what the Old Testament is completely different than what George Albert Smith and the First Presidency
right.
see the Old Testament being. And I experienced that as I started learning more about what the Old Testament was. And this is, I told you guys in an email that I wanted to talk about Moabites and Ammonites and incest.
So
Lowry Nelson makes this point about the in-group and the out-group, and how when you're an in-group, you see anybody that's an outsider, and you've got to justify why you can be shitty to them. You know, so you make up some story about why they became
right.
so awful. And
Samaritans,
right,
or whatever.
Right. The Samaritans. But so we've got this great story, and like it kind of dawned on me that this was going on as I was reading through the Old Testament one point, and I see there's the story of Lot when he's cast out of Sodom and Gomorrah, and his two daughters get him drunk. Do you remember this story?
Oh yeah.
Who could forget?
Yeah,
dude. It's
right.
one of the best stories in the Old Testament.
Forget about.
So what's the point of this story? The point of the story, you know, one night the oldest daughter sleeps with him, gets pregnant, and then the next night the younger daughter sleeps with him, gets pregnant, and it makes the point of saying the oldest daughter, this is the ancestor of the Moabites. And then the
right.
second one, this is the ancestor of the Ammonites. So you basically got this. What is it?
So what,
ex nihilo, like revisionist,
it's like
history.
Like the Targaryens. It's
no,
better.
Well, sure, but you're able to explain why is it that you can be shitty to the Moabite people and be shitty to the Ammonite people because they're products of incest, and they've got a blot on them and a mark on them right off the bat, even if the skin color is the same. But it's
right.
that whole
their family tree only has
thing.
One branch, right?
Yeah. That I thought was so fascinating, and it just makes sense that the Old Testament is a collection of these kinds of folk stories that the Hebrew people had to explain the world around them with themselves at the center of it. And we need to recognize those biases in it and not take it as gospel.
I loved when the First President says, yeah, it's always been this way. Even the Hebrews were like that. And Lowry's
yeah.
last response was, yeah, dude, they were racist too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. It was brilliant. And I've never thought of it that way when he says, yeah, had they known about the Japanese people, they would have
right.
found a way to marginalize the Japanese people. But
sure.
they did. So aren't we better than that? I want to say objectively true. When you say that, you just I can't help but stop and say, oh my gosh, that's so right. And that's why I think it's interesting that the First Presidency responds with, you know, the reason of men, no matter how well founded or whatever
yeah.
the line is,
no, just, how well it sounds,
yeah,
how reasonable it
yeah.
seems.
So are we going to talk about speculating his motivations by writing these letters? Do you think, like Glenn, I think you mentioned that he was just arrogant?
Oh, I didn't say arrogant.
What?
Really? No. All right. I just
pretended. I think he comes off it. He starts getting a little too. He's lecturing a little too much. He gets a little too deep and a little too long. So I did get a sense of arrogance on the. I think the second letter. The
yeah.
first letter, I love when he's like, "Hey, I'm just kind of. I hope this isn't the case. I'm just asking these questions. It can't be." But then his response, I think he gets a little heavy-handed.
I got the sense that he knew he was right.
Absolutely.
That's why he took
sure.
that's why he took the step. And that's why, you know, so many of you guys have called him a hero, and you know, look at the balls on this guy, cuz it was amazing to me that he stood his ground on that, because, you know, it seems like, you know, just like many of us, we've done our research, we've back-checked our sources. We're right about this. That's why we want to be heard on this.
You know Aggieland blogger Nate Sharp believes that he's a professor and a researcher.
He knows
Lowry Nelson's the Lowry real Nelson deal. Is. You know, and you can see the difference in approach in those two, where Nelson, it seems like he's going overboard, but he's teaching like he would teach a college class, and he's laying down a foundation, and he's giving the first point and the second point and the third point and the fourth point that go to a very reasonable conclusion to support his argument.
Yeah. I just did a presentation to a group of law enforcement and prosecutors, and one of my points that I make is, when you have the truth and you have evidence, then you should shoot every bullet and then throw the gun at him. And that's really what Lowry did. He unloaded on every piece, and he didn't hold back any of it. And that's why it was so long and so heady, I think. And he had his sources, he had his references, and he had his experience, and he hit him with everything.
So then, even after he did all those letters, he seemed to be pretty cordial towards the church. I mean, more so than I would have been, because it sounded like they were being completely dismissive and threatening to him.
He says, if this is the case, if this is the doctrine, I hope it's not, but I may need to rethink some things. He kind of made it sound like this is a line in the sand for him, and this could affect his his position in the church. That's what I read into it anyway. Maybe
you looked up and you saw his life, right? Like, he never left the church. He always stayed in good standing in the church. He never underwent any church discipline. I read something that was like a tribute at his funeral. I think it was, there was an article that was written, maybe it was a BYU studies. He taught at BYU, but he ended up kind of getting forced out a little bit by pressures, but that was the closest he ever came to the sanction. But he always supported the church. And even in these letters that he's writing, this is why I don't think he's being arrogant, Tom. I think he sincerely sees value in what the church can provide to the world.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
And I think he never deviates from that. It does seem like he's trying as politically as he can to softly correct them. What he sees is them, you know, steering way off course. This is his way of saying, hey, guys, I don't know if you guys know, but the church might be racist.
And even persuade. Yeah. It seemed like he was really trying to persuade them to you can do better than this, and there's real reasons why we shouldn't do this.
It's very similar to what John Hamer says to us when he's like, you guys, you don't need to sabotage yourself by all of the infantile immaturity that you have. It just, you know, stay the high road. Keep to the positive stuff. I mean, that's what I heard Lowry saying to them, to the first presidency. Don't bog down the great things that the church can do with this racist doctrine. Let's get rid of it.
But one of the things that we should mention here with his capacity to do that is that he's really dealing with an incredibly different church than what any of you guys or any of us have been ever dealt with, because this is prior to the creation of the massive corporate bureaucracy that the church has. So this, he really is writing a couple guys who have a couple guys around them, you know, who are, you know, who don't know anything, and like you say, they have the archives that they're sitting on of old lore that they're you know, going through and that they memorize or whatever, and that they're spitting back answers based on that lore that they've preserved. But it might have been very possible. Because the lived church experience was entirely outside of that hierarchy, so everybody is actually living in wards, and the wards are, you know, are more powerful relative to the center back then than they are now. So now wards are nothing. You know, everything has all been centralized. This entire thing is running at the center. There is no reform from outside. So now, you know, everyone, this guy would just be instantly crushed now. You know?
And if I remember right. You know, my dad, growing up in Arizona in this time, would say that I don't know if it was a general authority or if it was an apostle would come to every state conference. So it was just a much smaller church, much more accessible.
Sure.
Where he could write a letter to George Albert Smith and get a response.
And there could be a big thing. And reform was really possible, though.
They didn't have
because any one of these guys could really have changed something if there was enough of them together.
Right.
Because the problem with it was institutionally, because they all had to have all 15 of them ever want any change.
And the legal department and the PR.
Well, now.
Yeah, right.
Well, many of them were still alive through the changes of the polygamy, right? Because it's 1947, 1950, where many of the...
So it would have been.
Yeah, anyway.
Well, and were you surprised? I guess I was surprised at the makeup of the first presidency. I really don't know a lot about George Albert, but my understanding is certainly David O. McKay is considered a moderate, and I think J. Reuben Clark was as well. So two of the three there are two likable, people who are really respected. I don't know that they could ever that they were really the hardliners that you'd, you know, that Joseph F. or you know, even Harold B. Lee, so Ezra Taft, or these some of these guys that would have been there. These were two of the three were fairly moderate.
So, John, do you want to talk about the choice that you made for your reading of what was it? Anderson, was that his name? You made some very specific choices in your dramatic portrayal of the secretary of George Albert Smith.
Well, I just said that I thought that I was going to gay it up a bit. because for one thing, he was really a officious, male secretary here, right, to the guy. And then George Albert Smith is the one that there's the gay rumors of, right?
So is there really gay rumors on that?
I wanted Bob to double click on that.
I really don't know a lot about modern Utah Mormon history, so I really, the LDS Church isn't my area of focus, so I really, I don't remember. So I just let that go without really knowing, because I don't really care about modern Utah Mormon history at all.
There's a gay prophet rumor and you don't care about it? I just want to understand.
No, I don't care about that at all.
That's amazing.
I think I care
about it a lot all of a sudden.
Glenn already started the Boyd K. Packer in the closet rumor.
That's been around for a bit. I don't think that was Glenn's. That's like Glenn was the Bruce R., who really brought it.
How many of these have you? Okay, never mind. This is all just bullshit now. I thought it was.
I had heard that Boyd K. thing, that he had some talk about some friend that he lost in World War II, and it just that raised an eyebrow. Whatever. I don't know.
But what's this George Albert Smith one? Is this just Glenn messing with us in the moment, or is it a real?
Oh, this is John Hamer said it. Yeah.
Patriarch Joseph Fielding Smith's homosexuality, or
what did you Google Mormon gay?
Yeah,
or something?
Yeah, we're trying
no,
to look
I did.
Before
I did
anything.
George Albert Smith gay is what I googled, and it
George
came up
Albert
with the
Smith gay?
Patriarch Joseph Fielding
but,
Smith.
I mean,
and
it's,
then
the,
oh, yeah.
The internet is probably a gay profile for each prophet. It's just go down the list.
Right.
So yeah, maybe it's Joseph F. Smith II. I don't
Joseph
know.
Fielding, yeah, and not
Joseph. Whatever. Can we go back to, because I really want to read this essay if we can. I don't know if you want to, but man, it's so good.
Okay, so in the letters, the very last letter from this Joseph Anderson, he referenced an essay that Lowry Nelson had sent to David O. McKay to get approval to publish, and I think the last letter was, you don't need the approval, but my personal opinion is don't go against the prophet or you're on the wrong track.
Well,
something like that.
The impression that I got was that he was going to publish this in a worldly magazine or whatever. It was called the Nation, and just out of common courtesy, he sent a copy to the First Presidency of the Church saying, hey, I'm going to actually publish this, just as a heads up, it's somewhat critical. So that was actually, in my opinion, that was really nice and really cool of him, and he certainly didn't have to do that.
Sure.
But again, that just to me, it's like, it shows Nelson's willingness to still want to remain a member in good standing, because he was trying to work with the church by saying, hey, I've got issues. I'm going to take this beyond just the scope of the First Presidency. I'm going to take this out to the, quote, the world and see what happens.
And you can hear in this letter, as we read it, there's several things that came directly from, you can hear in this article, several things that came directly from the letters and the exchanges that, that I think you can connect dots.
You can hear his frustration too. That's what I know.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty short. Shall we read it?
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm straight.
Go, Tom.
Get in there, bro.
All right, so this is in The Nation, and it's on the very top, says, around the USA, Mormons and the Negro, St. Paul, Minnesota.
What year is this? Do we know? I didn't see it in the document.
1952. So it's five years after the supposed letters that we got, that you guys read. According to Mormon theology, the status of the Negro on Earth was determined in the pre-existent state, specifically in the War of Heaven, Revelations 12:4-7. As everyone knows, Lucifer rebelled and was cast down, taking with him one-third of the hosts of heaven. These are the sons of perdition. Michael clearly had a majority with him, some more active supporters than others, although I can find no scriptural basis for it. I have heard it said that the most active pro-Michael group was no more than one-third. The other third sat on the fence, refusing to take sides. The latter in... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and then, can we interrupt and talk about things?
Yeah, paragraph by paragraph?
Right. Yeah, because the idea... I mean, so first off, this is kind of like one of the crazier things is that this is a scriptural misreading. You know, so there is no, you know, war in heaven in the background in the past or something like that. The book of Revelations is talking, the guy is talking about a vision of the future. So this is a future war, you know, if you actually read Revelation.
But how common is the misunderstanding, John?
It's not common. It all outside of the English speaking world. Because it's common in the English speaking world, in part because a very early Anglo-Saxon Bible, verse Bible, included the war in heaven as in its rewriting of Genesis, and that got into the hands of Milton, and then Milton wrote a book called
Paradise Lost,
which is one of the most important books. It's like the English national epic, you know, and it was one of the few books that everybody would have just known backwards and forwards, and it completely influenced everybody's thinking. And so Mormon cosmology is based on Milton. I mean, this is Milton's misreading of Revelation. This doesn't happen in the Bible. So, and then this one-third thing, that's just the Revolutionary War. So you people,
Revolutionary War.
Yeah. So this idea is born from the idea that a third of the people in the Revolutionary War, you know, were the people who were the patriots, the people that fought against the British. A third of the people were the loyalists, who stayed with the English, and then a third of the people were the people that sat on the fence. You know, and so they are living in early Mormonism. They're living in the wake of this third thing, you know, from the American Revolution. And so that's where that's getting pasted onto, like he's saying, that's not in the Bible at all. That's just something that's part of their background and the only war that they've actually, you know, really experienced.
So isn't it
in the Pearl of Great Price, though? Isn't it in the Pearl of Great Price, the one-third
thing? No, it probably is, but it comes from the Revolutionary War. You know?
Okay, all right.
So Milton doesn't give that one-third, two-thirds designation in Paradise Lost?
No. Hmm. Well, not one-third, one-third, one-third. It might be a third of the hosts of heaven that go down, but it's not like there's fence-sitters in Milton.
Right, okay. All right.
All right. The other third, I'm going back just one sentence. The other third, quote, sat on the fence, refusing to take sides. The latter, in the Mormon lore of my boyhood days, was identified as the Negro. This places him in a sort of never-never land, a twilight zone between satanic hosts and those who are ready to be counted on the side of Michael. Thus, the blessings of the Mormon Church cannot be extended to anyone with Negro blood.
Wow. So he acknowledged, he came up with this term, Mormon lore of my boyhood. Is that allowed? Do we say that? Is that a thing? Mormon lore?
Yeah, why wouldn't it be? He quoted a folklorist in the letters.
Right.
The guy that did the in and the out group.
It's like an academic view of... I'm just thinking like from a theology
perspective.
This
is an academic magazine that he's writing in, though, isn't it? That's his audience?
Yeah, I think so.
Members.
Okay, but then he's talking about, I couldn't find this in the doctrine, there's no scriptural basis for it, so... I don't know. He's kind of writing this line of, I guess, writing to an outsider audience, but still using insider. All right, it's fine. I was surprised.
He's discrediting or delegitimizing what Mormons would call doctrine. So what the first presidency has written to him and said is doctrine, revealed by Joseph Smith even. Mm. He's saying, no, this is just lore that's running around in the church.
But isn't he setting up his discovery that, like, he thought... he thought that it was just lore because he heard it as a kid, and he didn't have it confirmed until later, and he's going to tell that story.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. All right.
Makes so he sense. Assumed it was lore.
Yeah.
It is lore.
It is lore, and
now
was,
now it's lore.
He heard it. So by calling it the lore of his boyhood, he's suggesting that in his mind this was always something that was suspect. He knew that it was out there, but it was suspect. It hadn't been officially canonized until he had this experience, and I think he's going to talk about that. But I don't remember.
But doesn't this lore get expounded on when Bruce R. comes in and does the Mormon doctrine thing? Well, I mean, because this never goes away.
Yeah.
Well, probably Bruce R. Maybe Bruce R. read this and he's like, "Is that ain't lore?"
Right. Yeah.
That's
probably.
Fact.
Probably.
All right. Who's got the second paragraph?
I'll take it. This is Bob. This unfortunate policy of the church is a source of embarrassment and humiliation to thousands of its members, the writer among them, who find no basis for it in the teachings of Jesus, whom all Mormons accept as the Savior. The issue has become increasingly important as members of the church outside of Utah and adjacent states have increased rapidly in recent years and are brought into direct contact with Negroes, and who see their fellow Christians engaged in programs to reduce racial prejudice, programs in which they cannot fully participate. Such persons would like to see the policy altered in the interest of peace and simple humanitarianism. Well, that's such a pragmatic approach. I like it. Can't disagree. I mean,
but he also makes the way here for them to be able to do it by allowing him to say this is just a policy, and you could change a policy. So I mean, he's actually suggesting a path of potential reform, and it is the path that they ultimately take.
Right. 25 years later, but yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, and if you want to say 25 years later, it's even more than that. It's still last year with the essay that formally says this was just a policy.
And I wonder.
They all were racist. Exactly.
I wonder if, in a way, he's trying to bait the church to come out and you know, so he's presenting this as this lore of his boyhood that's just a policy. He knows that he's had these letters. He knows what David O. McKay, as a member of the First Presidency, thought in the letters exchanged from 1947. So I wonder if he's sending this to McKay, asking him to either clarify now, or is it still the policy? Is it official doctrine? What is it? And almost bait him into a response.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think he was trying to nail him down. Like, kid, can we get specific? Is this the lore, the actual doctrine?
Yeah. Where do we put the nails in this jello?
All right.
The doctrine of white race superiority, so much the vogue in the early 19th century when Mormonism had its beginning, has been so thoroughly debunked as to catalog its adherents today as either grossly uninformed or victims of traditional irrational prejudices or both.
Whoa, ouch.
Am I wrong to just apply gay or LGBT
right,
to
exactly.
this?
Exactly, you could say
it's
the
so
exact
easy.
Same thing today.
Yeah, but let's wait. Let's
All right. Mormons as a group are not ignorant people. They rank high in formal schooling with an extraordinarily high proportion of college graduates. Many of them naturally find it difficult to reconcile what they learn in college. I got to scroll up. About racial differences and equalities with the stand taken by their church. Curiously, the position of the church on the Negro does not carry over to other racial groups. Natives of the South Seas, Mongolians, and American Indians are given a clean bill of health, and Mormons, according to their theology, regard the Jews as their own kin! Exclamation point. The doctrine, however, does not mean there is no anti-Semitism among Mormons, but that is another problem.
Wait, what? This is beautiful. I love this paragraph because he really does nail down the problems. He's like, all these other racial groups they got a clean bill of health. I love that.
It's the level of pigment in your skin. It's the saturation.
You're not dark enough. So
no,
you're
this is another nod to the Mike Tannehill way of seeing things. It's the family line. So it's not about pigment color. It really is racial bigotry towards those of African descent.
Right. There's a comedian that talks about every race has somebody that they that they dislike or that they, you know, think are less than at some point. It's kind of that thing is where the Mormons just say, we have acknowledged who the lowest of the low when it comes to racial minorities are.
Yeah.
It's pretty sickening, really. What is this anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. I'm like, what? That's just out of left field for me.
I've never heard that, experienced that, sensed that. I've always thought that there's a – it's almost embarrassing how connected the Mormons try to be towards, you know, the Israelites or Jewish people.
Who killed Jesus?
You think that's what he's talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's ask Mel Gibson. What does he think?
Right. But it's still like they'll go, oh yeah, the Jews are a brother tribe of ours, but Ephraim is best because the Ephraim.
We're all right, Ephraim.
Ephraim didn't, you know, like only you know that there's also this folk doctrine, this lore that only the Jews were wicked enough to actually crucify their savior.
Yeah, no, like I have
that's,
heard that.
That's an anti-Semitic.
Yeah, now that you say that, I have heard that.
Mormonism,
but
you know?
But the difference is that that's like in the past. Like,
well, but this is close to World War II, so he may have been familiar with conversations, and I'm just speculating here, with people who justified the Holocaust because it was the sins of the fathers that were being visited on the heads of the children.
Right.
No, and you're absolutely right, Glenn. I have heard members kind of, well, you know, that was a form of punishment for what they did to Jesus.
Yeah, right. They had it coming.
Yeah, I actually have. Wow, totally.
That's just crazy. All right. Okay, but we're not ignorant as Mormons. Totally makes sense.
All right. I'll take the next one. The basic question remains as to whether the church will modify its present stand on the matter. Perhaps a more important question is, can it change? Theoretically, the church has a means by which its doctrines may be modified. It was founded upon the idea of progressive revelation, that as God spoke to the people in the Bible days, so he continues to do today through the head of the church. An announcement ex cathedra on this question would be accepted by the body of the church, joyfully by some, although no doubt reluctantly by others. Jeez, it is recognized,
revelatory.
Yeah. It is recognized, of course, that it is very difficult for a religion based upon revelation to modify its doctrines, but few other denominations have the procedures for change that the Mormon Church has. The leaders of this church are men of goodwill. It is difficult to believe that deep in their own hearts they are not troubled by the ethical problems which this bit of dogma presents. See, he's totally baiting them there because he knows.
He's planting seeds there, yeah.
He's making them look stupid because he knows that they really do deeply have this in their hearts.
Yeah, it's like, hey, you guys.
He's calling them
just
out.
Look deep down. Come on, you know this is a problem, just like I do. Come on.
He's saying, how do you guys live with yourself? Is what
how do you sleep at night, you guys?
But he has these weird backhanded compliments that are like, you know, because the Mormon Church, unlike other churches, has this really sophisticated way of changing things, and it just begs the question, like, so that would mean that there would be a lot of other churches that still don't, you know, work with the Negro post 1978, right? Because we wouldn't be.
This is not 1978, though.
No. I'm just saying we wouldn't be super late as a church if his statement held true that we have some sort of superior process by which we can change things.
But think, you know,
I think he's suggesting this as a potential mechanism. In other words, he's not saying that they're ever using this mechanism that they could be using. He's saying, look, guys, there's a real – you've got an escape hatch right here. You can use this mechanism. Anytime you want to turn the machine on and press the button, it'll work. But you just are not doing it, you know, whereas other churches have to go through hell and high water in order to admit that they were wrong about anything because they don't have any way of saying, oh, well, now we got new information. You know, they don't have that. You know?
But is also, that really true? Other churches don't have a way to change? Like
hang on a second. This guy is writing this knowing that he has the threat of excommunication hanging over his head.
Yeah,
and he's not stupid. So everything that he says and the way that he says it, he's going to do it in a way that if he's ever called into a court, he can say, but look what I said. I said the church is great. I said the church has all these fantastic things. I said they're good people. I said yeah. this, you know, so I think that's a very real part of why he's saying what he's saying that we can't ignore.
No, totally. I think it's for those, the motivation is clear. I'm just challenging it as a independent of his motivation. Is it really that accurate, or is it just like this sort of praiseworthy?
It's a rah rah. It's just rah rah. Yeah.
It has no basis in anything. Like, our church has a better system of change. Like,
It's not a better system. I'm saying that he's saying, I think, though, that there's an obvious mechanism here that would work without creating a very serious problems that other churches go through. So it is really hard for other churches, even liberal denominations are racked by how they can deal with embracing marriage equality, because they're filled with older people and it's a generational issue. And how do they, and the older people, you know, are already committed to an opinion, and so it's been hard, you know, so even very liberal churches have been torn apart over it.
Well, is it true that the Church of Christ, or the Community of Christ, sorry, when they gave priesthood, that had a real impact on attendance? Did people left over that? Is that, I've heard that.
A lot of people left over that. And so, and that was a case of actually using this mechanism, and it caused a problem.
Right.
Since there was a revelation. And, you know, on the other hand, more in the more recent one, the sort of amazing transition with DNC 164, where the church embraced marriage equality, you know, in a country by country basis, anyway, it's studied by other denominations, because almost everybody else has gone through such horrible, you know, have torn their churches apart over that, whereas there's almost no defections at all in Community of Christ.
Oh, interesting.
I want to go back to one thing about this being this pro rah rah church message that he's giving, because it's almost like coded language in a secular delivery to say that the church is the one true mouthpiece of God and has, you know, so like he's able to say that without saying it.
Right. Yeah.
It's kind of like a nod to the insiders this is the way I'm telling them that we're the one true church with revelation and a prophet at our head that we can do this.
You also take the second paragraph and this paragraph together. He gives them an either or. Either you could say this is a policy, but if not that, just apply your revelation. Yeah. Do either one, guys.
You got plenty of options. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, John, you got the next one.
A very real difficulty is the fact that those who disapprove the church's attitude have no way of expressing their point of view. It is safe to say that most of the 1 million members give passive assent to the present policy. For most of those living in Utah and the adjacent states, the Negro question is academic. They hardly ever see Negroes, much less live in the same community with them. In any case, they would find comfortable agreement with the white supremacy idea because of latent historical prejudices which they share with so many other white people. However, my knowledge of the deep humanitarianism of the Mormon people leads me to think that if the question could be openly discussed, they would line up on the side of justice.
Wow.
Because he's got high hopes. He's got... Yeah. You want to sing? Are we going to sing? No.
No, we're not going to sing.
High apple pie in the...
Great.
Sky!
Oh, so anytime you're feeling low.
Yeah.
Gotta let him go.
This one speaks for itself really well.
So he grew up in Minnesota, and so he, or rather not meant to grow up in Minnesota. Anyway, he's living here in Minnesota, in where he's writing this. He's a professor in Minnesota, and I grew up a Mormon in Minnesota, and so Minnesota is this other state that would have been, you know, like Utah. There were not a lot of black people, right?
Right.
So there, and so you're in the situation, but the two states then were able to have these completely separate courses. So whereas Utah didn't have any black people, they were just completely willing to just accept this bigotry, this because it's part of their lore, you know. And so therefore, even though there was a high percentage of people who were college educated, you know, they were still politically aligned then with the Deep South, where there weren't a lot of highly educated people in a proportion of the population. Whereas in Minnesota, it was a lot easier to be, you know, really, you know, race neutral and to be on the leading edge of all the civil rights issues and everything like that. you know, so Hubert H. Humphrey of Minnesota is like the guy who stands up in the Democratic convention and announces that the racists have to get out of the Democratic Party, which, you know, changed the entire alignment of the political parties throughout all of our lifetimes. So, but the part of it is that makes it somewhat easier to do that is because there also weren't any black people, right? So it's like two sides of this. There's not any black people question, you know. So
makes sense.
All right, so the next one. Such, and this is the good one because this is where he says, I could be excommunicated. Such open discussion, especially in print, however, is a perilous undertaking for any member. It automatically leaves him open to the charge of disobedience to constituted authority, which may lead to his being excommunicated. The upshot is that discussions by interested persons are largely so. What's that word?
Subrosa.
It's by cutoff. Subrosa?
Looks like
an I there. So widespread are such discussion groups that they might be said to constitute a Mormon underground. The participants are not disloyal church members. Rather, they are generally active in the church and rationalize their conduct by weighing the many admirable features of their religion against the features with which they disagree.
This could have been written yesterday. It's like, wow, it's the same as it is today.
Yeah, the Mormon underground, the Damu.
Well, not the Damu, but I was thinking more like Sunstone and you know, getting together and having a Sunday dinner and talking about something intellectual at the same time as something religious without it like making the universe explode like the prophets and apostles of today assume.
It does sound like he's saying, hey, there should be a space for us to still believe and be supportive and, you know, and still vote in the affirmative, but still have, you know, objections or, you know.
Right, and so he's part of the leading edge of this. So he's part of the leading edge of this community, this Mormon, independent Mormon community that creates dialogue.
Right.
And then ultimately Sunstone, MHA, all of these independent institutions that are, that do create those, the goal of this open forum, which at a certain point then the church leaders take as being, you know, rebellious and opposition, and they go to war with and have been at war with ever since. So
right, this is so this is early days. Do we have any records of this kind of open acknowledgement of the Mormon underground, so to speak, before? I mean, this is early 1950s. I'm sure it existed before this. It's just that for me, seeing it written so clearly, this is the earliest record I've seen of this kind of acknowledgement of.
Yeah, he might have been part of the grassroots. Who knows?
I don't know. That's what it seems like.
Who's got the last one? Is that you, Glenn?
Bob.
Is it Bob?
Sure.
Bob or Matt. Yeah.
In writing this article for publication, the author does so in a spirit of constructive criticism and in the conviction that his church, with so many admirable qualities and achievements to its credit, is faced by a challenge to place itself alongside those other groups which are laboring against racial bigotry. Signed, Lowry Nelson. And then it has in brackets, the writer is a lifelong member of the Mormon Church. All right.
And a big amen from me. Yeah.
Gotta give applause, man. Well done. Yeah.
What was that, Matt?
Nothing. I said, well done.
Yeah.
So, this may not be related to this, but I'm going to tell a quick story. I was on my flight today, and I was next to a missionary that was coming home, and we started having a conversation and eventually disclosed my position, and he asked, well, what do you believe? I said, well, I believe a lot of things. My beliefs now just are based on what's objective and what causes harm to people. For example, racism is wrong, period, and it was wrong in the Bible, it was wrong in the Book of Mormon, it was wrong in the history of the church. Just because God claimed it was okay doesn't mean it was okay. So I just am against racism generally. So the sad thing is you're a racial minority. It was a Hispanic kid. You're a racial minority, and you're forced to defend a racist practice. That really sucks. And he just kind of nodded.
He nodded?
Yeah.
Yeah, he just kind of nodded.
Mm. Yeah, it sucks kid. To be me, man.
Yeah, it sucks pretty bad. So what do you recommend? Yeah, I remember you recommend you start reading. Anyway, because this has been so much in my mind of being immoral, of being unethical, and especially when you use God you know, to be so immoral and unethical. And it's just been on the forefront of my mind. So when he asked that question, I just jumped right to this. To me, this is the smoking gun. And so easily demonstrates not only that there's no revelation, but that the church has really done harm and done bad things with the power that it has, and it continues to do that now with our gay and lesbian friends and brothers and sisters.
So, but why do you think it is and it isn't the smoking gun? Because it disproportionately, it's gotten almost no attention. And because we all just acknowledged at the beginning of this podcast that most of us hadn't heard of it until now. And I think the church, even for the progressive community or those that are X now, all of the issues are centered around when the church takes action. So 1978 rather than this letter in the 50s. Uh-huh. And it makes me wonder if, you know, it's kind of a revisionist history sort of thing. Like all of the things that really concern me about the church are just the culmination of a lot of stuff that was even worse before that I just haven't seen because it's not from the perspective of the church making a PR statement about it. Does that make sense? Like, so
it will when I listen back to it.
if you want, but I mean, really, I mean, I kind of mentioned, I really have made the decision a long time ago that I can't study Utah Mormon history after Brigham Young takes his group west, because there's too much other things to study. But if people were to sit down and just read about the modern, the 20th century history of the LDS Church or Brigham Young, or even from Brigham Young to, you know, the 50s and 60s, it would be horrific. So you would just find stuff like this. It's just all up and down. You know, it's none of this is recirculated. Like I said, right. We don't have anything about George Albert Smith. If people, you know, there's a wonderful J. Reuben Clark biography, read, there's the David O. McKay biography by Greg Prince, you know, so read those books and you're going to find plenty of this stuff.
Yeah.
Mm. What I find interesting, though, is isn't this essentially kind of like a cautionary tale for stuff that's happening now, like with the ordained women and the potential backlash with the homosexuality communities? It seems to me like there's a lot of people that are yelling at the church, obviously being ignored and whatnot, but they're telling them, hey, pull your heads out of your asses. Let's make some change. Modern revelation. You guys remember that escape hatch that you guys have that you're not using? Modern revelation. You can make the change if you want to. It seems to me like this is a good example of
right.
someone back in the 40s and 50s trying this, obviously failing because they shut him down. But then in 1978, you know, somewhere wherever he was, I don't know if he was still alive, but he must have cheered like, dude, I was totally vindicated.
Well, and they did with these issues that you're talking about, these modern issues, ordained women, marriage equality. Same gender attraction.
No. You asshole.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But they did the same thing as they did back then, which is they doubled down and said, "Well, hell yeah, and more. Let's really tell you what our positions are." So they did the exact same thing. It really is Groundhog Day with these issues as it was with the Lowry Nelson issues with them. Double down and saying, yeah, we meant it and we mean it more. So it is crazy they haven't learned from it.
Right. So are we going to see in 20, 30 years the church make changes that they should be making now?
I believe so. John doesn't. John thinks they'll never embrace marriage equality, right?
What about right. women in the priesthood?
Right, I believe they won't do that because this isn't a new issue. And ordained women isn't a thing that just came up in 2014 or 13 or something like that. The church was...
Right.
Busily, the church defeated the ERA. It was the thing. It was just like the ERA is like a Prop 8. You know, it's the thing that the church was able to do.
And it was polarizing back then.
70s. That's the 70s. You know. Yeah. So. Yeah.
And we, if you look at Bednar, who's like the young guy, I mean, he's still just as pathetic as the old ones. Like it's going to take a really young guy, or I don't know, maybe 50 years is enough.
I've said 100 years. I figure.
Well, so 100 years is beyond the foreseeable future. So I don't know. You know, yeah. Who knows? I'm not saying that in 100 years. Who knows?
Don't you think you'd have to have a larger majority of disaffected women in the church? Because I think you've got a growing vocal minority, but I don't think that most women in the church really see it as a problem. And as long as that's the case, it's easier to maintain the status quo.
According to the polls, they don't. The majority don't. And the other thing about it is there's a constant self-selection. So as everybody's constantly leaving, you know, from the all of these Lowry Nelsons are leaving now. Or getting X'd in the case. He would get X'd. But anyway, other people that are of the same mind are just leaving silently. So that's self-selecting the population that's remaining inside. And ultimately, there is a thing, too, about the international church, even though no one ever thinks about the international church, and not probably the leaders don't think about it too much, but the international church is, in the developing world, is probably largely more conservative on these issues, you know, and they would have to think about that too, which is a big deal.
But aren't members in the European countries and in the other first world countries, they're fleeing, right? I mean, the Swedes.
Yeah, but it's already so the church is already destroyed. The Mormon church is already destroyed in Europe, so that's over. So now what are you going to do? You would be obviously writing off Africa, and you know, so
right. So can I go back? Because I did want to mention that the First Presidency did respond to Lowry. Yeah. To this article. So because
that was the same letter that John read from Joseph Anderson, wasn't it?
Was it the President McKay one?
That President McKay said you can go ahead and publish it if you want to, but my opinion is that don't cross
Oh, was that the same one?
I think that's the source of it. Yeah.
But yeah, okay. it was a dick move. Yeah,
yeah, because it wasn't the First Presidency directly responding. It was the
secretary.
The gay secretary.
But
it's also that in there.
The dramatized gay secretary.
The fabulous secretary. Yeah.
You can do whatever you want, but...
Yeah, that's the thing that cracks me up, the passive aggressiveness.
Right, I should like to add up my own.
If I were you, I wouldn't do it. I'm just saying.
It contained no date.
I have less to say on this.
Outdated.
Yeah.
With poor punctuation.
I mean, it's also like a crazy long, you know, sentence because, again, the guy has such this incredible officious speak. I should like to add on my own account, however, that when a member of the church sets himself up against doctrines preached by the prophet Joseph Smith and by those who have succeeded him in the high office which he held, he is moving into a very dangerous position for himself personally.
Insert wink. You know what I'm saying?
I would have liked a response. I didn't ask.
Yeah. Exactly. Don't care about what you think yourself personally. Joseph.
Thanks, secretary.
Yeah.
Go set an appointment.
Yeah. So you know, on the question of whether gender is eternal.
Yeah.
You know, and so we were also talking about like the early church and race and everything like that. So in Sunday school on Sunday, actually, I read the patriarchal blessing that Joseph Smith Sr. gave to Elijah Abel.
Mm.
And that elucidates what at least Joseph Smith Sr.'s thinking on the question was. So, you know, Brother Abel, in the name of Jesus, I lay my hands upon thy head and bless thee. Thou shalt be blessed forever. I seal upon you a father's blessing, you know, et cetera. Thou hast been ordained an elder and anointed to secure thee against the power of the destroyer. Thou shalt see his power in laying waste the nations and wicked slaying the wicked, while the blood shall run. Now, this is like he's going to have this. He's going to see in the future during Armageddon the wicked slaying the wicked, while the blood shall run down in the streets like water. Thou shalt weep over their calamities. Angels shall visit thee. Thou shalt receive comfort. They shall call thee blessed and deliver thee from thine enemies. Thou shalt break thy bands and keep thee from thy afflictions. Thy name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Thou shalt travel to the east and visit foreign countries, speak in all the foreign tongues. Thou shalt be able to teach different languages. Thou shalt see visions of the world in other worlds and comprehend the laws of all kingdoms and confound the wisdom of this generation. Thy life shall be preserved to a good old age. Thou must seek first the kingdom of heaven, and all the blessings will be added thereto. Thou shalt be made equal to thy brethren, and thy soul shall be white in eternity, and thy robes glittering.
Wow. White in eternity?
Thy soul shall be... I'm sorry. And thy soul be white in eternity.
Oh my gosh.
I think it would have been easier for him to say what wasn't going to happen. I mean, that was just a pretty exhaustive list.
What year was that? Do you know?
1836.
Yeah, because he later he went up to Canada and was involved in some skirmishes up there for some people that wanted to break away from the Queen or something like that. I remember there were some really bloody things that he saw there. That's interesting. Anyway,
I can't even imagine what that would be like.
If you're a black person and somebody says you one day are going to be white like me,
your soul.
Well, the whole blessing is great because essentially what I was picturing is that same blessing could have been given to Bruce Willis right before he went to the Nakatomi Plaza because it's so good.
Yeah.
But then at the very end, there's like that shit icing on the cake. Like, yeah. Oh yeah, so you'll be white in eternities, man. If I was African American and I heard that blessing, I'd be all pumped up. And then at the very end, I'm like, wait, what? I'm gonna be white in the eternities?
It doesn't say anything about Ephraim. Did they not do that back then?
It was inconsistent. Usually, a lot of times, Joseph Smith Sr. would say you're of the lineage of Joseph because that's in the Book of Mormon. No, because it's in the Book of Mormon, and so the Book of Mormon predicts that a seer that is of the lineage of Joseph of Egypt, who is his name will be the same as his father's name, right, will come forth, right? Right. And so the idea, therefore, is that Joseph Smith Sr. and Joseph Smith Jr. and all the Smiths are of the lineage of Joseph of Egypt. Yeah. And Joseph of Egypt's more blessed, his second son, but it's his more blessed son is Ephraim, right? Ephraim. And so that's why Mormons often consider themselves to, you know, it comes down through this, so the idea is that they're from that tribe because that's where that, it comes from there in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
And so anyways, but they did do it sometimes but inconsistently in the first patriarchal blessings, and then they would also pick people from different tribes. It wasn't always Ephraim, but often it would just say of Joseph.
Wow. All right. So let's put a freaking lid on this thing, man.
Yeah.
That's good.
And I think we're that's just a nice the same light thing now with the issues of the day. Hey, so related to this, I want to ask your take on the verse. Was it Galatians 3:28 where it talks about there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither bond nor free, there's neither male nor female, for you're all one in Christ Jesus. Isn't that support for who gives a shit about gender?
Right. And so that's like why you know, Lowry here is right when he kept on making the point that this isn't what we should be believing as Christians, you know.
Right.
Because this is inimical to Jesus' teachings and the teachings of the New Testament. So
when did you start reading the Old Testament again, Matt? Wow.
That was
impressed.
The New Testament. That's the New Testament, bro.
Oh yeah, Gavin. Yeah, sorry.
Mm. Nice one, Tom. You've been going to church more recently than me.
It doesn't mean I've been reading my Bible though.
that's one of those New Testament books that I never. It's like in the middle. It's not Revelation and it's not the Gospel.
It's right between Exodus and Song of Solomon.
It's nice. So.
This is when the party ends. I can't stand here listening.
Hi, this is Nick from Los Angeles, and when I'm not spending time with my counterfeit family, I'm listening to Infants on Thrones. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
This is where the party ends. I just sit here wondering.
I have a story that I'd like to end on.
All
right. We've already ended, but yeah. Go story time. Story time with Glenn.
My 11-year-old son has a really good friend who's a black kid, and they spent the night over at his house two nights ago, and then they came and spent the night here yesterday. And so as I'm driving them over here, this boy says to me this really random statement. He's like, "Have you ever seen a black and white waterfall devour a pizza?" What? He goes, "Have you ever seen a black and white waterfall devour a pizza? We had pizza last night." And I'm like, "Oh, dude, do you call yourselves that? That you're the black and white waterfall? And he's like, wait, no, we got kittens, and one of them's black and white, and his name is Waterfall.
Oh, the trap.
That's good. Yeah. Is Glint racist?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was, did that make me racist?
I was trying to put some context.
I was gonna say when the story started and you're like, my son has a black friend. Like, this is already gonna be a racist story. So yeah. Well.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.